Ladies and gentlemen, good evening and a very warm welcome to Westminster Abbey on behalf of the Dean and Chapter. This is the third and final public lecture in the series celebrating the 400th anniversary of the King James Version of the Bible. Details of forthcoming further series of lectures exploring issues of faith, society and theology are on your seats, so do please feel free to take one, even if you've taken one before, please take another. And if you'd like to have advance notice of these events and similar events, there's also a form on your seats to fill in with contact details. Please leave these on your seats. In the first lecture of this series, the Lord Chief Justice described the legal and historical context of the time in which the King James Bible was being translated. He described a fluid and turbulent time, which was also extraordinarily formative for our subsequent history. Then last week, Lord Bragg gave us a wide-ranging survey of the actual impact of that King James Bible on that subsequent history, its effect on our language and literature, as well as on social issues and democracy. So that brings us to tonight, when Nick Spencer will be focusing very specifically on the role of the Bible in politics. And I should say, incidentally, that if anyone is following this or wishes to follow this lecture tonight on Twitter, or if you are yourselves tweeting, then the most useful hashtag is POLBible, P-O-L, Bible. Back to Nick. Nick is research director at the public theology think tank Theos, a co-sponsor with the Abbey of this lecture series. So we're already indebted to Nick, even before he utters a word tonight. He previously worked as research director at the London Institute for Contemporary Christianity and as researcher and writer for the Jubilee Centre. He writes on issues of religion and society. He's the author of a number of Theos reports, including Doing God and Neither Private Nor Privileged. He writes for a number of publications, including The Guardian and Third Way magazine, and is the author of a number of books, most recently Freedom and Order, History, Politics, and the English Bible. So that all makes him exceptionally well qualified to contribute to this series on the English Bible, and we are delighted to welcome him here tonight for the final lecture of the series, Why the Bible is the Foundation of British Politics. Nick Spencer.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Vernon, for those warm words of introduction. It is an honour and a privilege to be standing here tonight, a somewhat daunting one as well, I have to confess. As Vernon said, this is the third in our series on law, politics and the Bible, the first two being delivered by Lord Judge, Chief Justice, Lord Bragg, our foremost cultural and literary commentator. So it's perhaps appropriate that the third lecture should be delivered by a commoner, such as myself. I am research director at Theos, and I travel around the country doing talks of a similar nature, and it's flattering and gratifying to receive a number of honorary doctorates from the different organisations that I speak at. They naturally assume that if you are research director of a public theology think tank, you have a doctorate. I am always disappointed to have to inform them that that isn't necessarily the case. I'm particularly disappointed to inform those that award me a professorship when I come and speak to them that I'm not a professor. I do, however, have an active interest in the Bible, in Christianity, and in particular in its relationship to our political life. And that is going to be my subject tonight. I want to begin with a book review. In 2009, the Sunday Times reviewed two books by the distinguished New Testament historian Geza Vermes. At one point in the review, it was a single review of two books, at one point in the review, the reviewer, who shall remain nameless, wrote the following two sentences. Jesus' main concern was healing the sick, comforting the poor, and preaching about the coming kingdom of God. He had no interest in politics, revolution, or theology. Now, it is, to put it mildly, an odd statement. The idea that kingdom is not a political term, God is not a theological term, and the preaching about the coming of the kingdom of God is not a revolutionary act, however we understand that word revolutionary, is somewhat strange. Strange, perhaps, but not, I fear, unusual. Christianity may have got involved in all manner of murky political endeavours down the centuries, but Jesus himself was apparently entirely apolitical. And we often get a similar view when we engage with the Bible. Its influence on our language and our literature and our culture has been immense. Thus, Professor Dawkins, talking to the King James Bible Trust last year, said this: "You can't appreciate English literature until you are steeped to some extent in the King James Bible. Not to know the King James Bible is to be in some small way barbarian." Now, I have to confess, I don't always find myself in total agreement with Professor Dawkins, but on this occasion, I can offer him a hearty amen, even if I do cavil slightly at the barbarian. It is indeed very difficult to fully understand or appreciate English literature without some knowledge of the Bible, and in particular the King James translation. But I would go further and to argue that just as it is impossible to understand our national literature without recourse to the Bible, so it is impossible to understand our politics. Indeed, I would go further still and claim that the Bible has been the single most influential text in our political history. Now, it's important to get two enormous caveats in straight away. The first is that to claim for the Bible such an influence is not to claim that it has been the only influence on our national politics. The Bible has always worked alongside other ideas, other ideologies, other circumstances. It has always shared the national political stage, even between the late 1530s and the late 1650s, when it was undoubtedly the lead actor on that stage. The second caveat is that to make such a claim for the Bible is not to say that it has always been used on the side of the political angels. It has not. The Christian scriptures have, over the centuries, been used to justify political disenfranchisement, subservience, and inequality. It's sobering to recognise, for example, that one of the reasons why the abolitionist campaign 200 years ago, the campaign to abolish the slave trade, one of the reasons why it was so explicitly biblical was that there were intelligent, thoughtful, erudite, biblically literate Christians on the other side of the argument who justified the transatlantic slave trade on explicitly biblical grounds. And there's no way of getting round historical inconveniences like that. To claim such a significant role for the Bible, then, is not to airbrush history. Rather, it is simply to say that just as it is impossible to understand national literature without understanding the Bible, so it is impossible to understand national politics. What I want to do is give you a handful of examples of what I mean by that, and then conclude by really posing a question. My first example. We owe our nation, our notion of England, and subsequently of Britain, as political entities, as opposed to geographic or ethnic entities, to the Bible. What do I mean by this? Well, when Pope Gregory sent his missionaries to the English people in 597, the English people did not exist. In its place were numerous separate militaristic kingdoms that lived in a state of more or less constant conflict. Conceiving them as a single unit and sending his missionary to them was a momentous move on the Pope's part, leading one recent British historian to remark, somewhat provocatively, that the English owe their existence as a people, or at least the recognition of it, to the papacy. Now, nation building is a slow process, and it was a slow process in this nation. It was still going on 130 years later when the first and the greatest of the Anglo-Saxon historians, the Venerable Bede, wrote his hugely influential and important ecclesiastical history of the English people. Bede considered himself to be a biblical scholar long before he considered himself to be a historian. It just so happens that only his history is read today. His biblical scholarship is confined to specialists. But it's not surprising, then, that this ecclesiastical history of the English people, again written at the time when the English people didn't really exist, is replete with subtle biblical motifs. Bede is, in fact, continuing this process of creating the English people, and he's drawing on the Bible to do so. More influential than either Gregory or Bede, however, is King Alfred, and in particular in his response to the Viking invasions that had begun to terrorise the shores from 793 onwards. Those invasions were widely understood as a sign of divine judgment, and King Alfred was determined to respond and repent accordingly. He felt very strongly that you could organise your armed forces and fortify your towns as much as you liked. If you didn't have God on your side, it wouldn't make a difference. And so, as well as his military preparations, he embarked on an extensive reform of ecclesiastical, educational and moral life of the people, much of which centred on a conscious turning to the Bible. And it was in this context that he issued a seminal law code in the last decade of his reign, in the 890s, a code which explicitly integrated the earlier law codes from the other English kingdoms and illustrated an explicit and repeated biblical basis. Some examples. It begins with the Ten Commandments from Exodus 20 and then 66 verses of Mosaic law after that. It then moves from the Old Testament to the New by means of Christ's words in Matthew's Gospel, "Think not that I am come to destroy the law." It explains that Christ had not come to shatter or annul the commandments but to fulfill them. And he taught mercy and meekness. It then quotes from the Golden Rule from Matthew 7:12, of which it remarks, "A man can think on this one sentence alone that he judges each one rightly. He has no need of other law books." The law code itself is less explicitly biblical, but it is divided into 120 chapters. 120 being the age at which Moses died, the number of believers in the earliest church, and standing for law in the number symbolism of the early Middle Ages. Now, historians have observed that, at least as existing manuscripts preserve it, Alfred's law code would have been more or less useless in a court. It's disordered and it's full of contradictions. It was not, however, intended to provide a comprehensive law code for English society. Rather, Alfred's law code was meant to be powerfully symbolic, placing the king's legislative activity on an historical stage that stretched back through the early church and Christ to Moses and the divine law itself. By explicitly acknowledging and integrating earlier Anglo-Saxon law codes, those from Kent and Mercia specifically, this king of the West Saxons was consciously integrating the historically warring English kingdoms into a whole in the face of a pagan menace that came from overseas. He was, in effect, inviting the people to see themselves as even the people of God. Alfred helped forge the identity of a Christian people that was defending itself against a violent, irreligious menace in much the same way as Old Testament Israel had done. It's no surprise that the Anglo-Saxons had a particular affinity from the Old Testament. The vast majority of Anglo-Saxon biblical poetry draws on many of the heroic deeds of the Old Testament. They're not quite sure what to do with the meekness and forgiveness in the New Testament. The Old Testament is a people they can identify with. Alfred, in effect, helps form the idea of the English people by means of biblical law and narrative, by placing them firmly within God's protection and his purposes for the world. As with England, so with Britain, albeit in rather different historical circumstances. Scroll forward 700 or 800 years or so to the 1670s, the country is still living in the shadow of two painful civil wars followed by a decade of political instability. There were, however, more pressing worries at the time, namely the Catholicism of James, Charles II's brother and the heir to the throne. Tensions grow throughout the 1670s. Parties divide into Tory and Whig. When James succeeded to the throne and then 3 years later secured a male heir, civil war beckons again. Now, the fact that the nation did not descend into civil war and that James was unseated largely peaceably in favour of the Protestant William and Mary of Orange was judged by many at the time to be little short of a miracle. And this so-called glorious revolution would inform national politics for the next two centuries. The ensuing Bill of Rights, passed by Parliament in 1689, secured a limited kingship, parliamentary privilege, and a subject's right to petition the monarch. The Act of Toleration, also from 1689, helped effect a rapprochement between Anglicans and dissenters, exempting from punishment those dissenters who were prepared to take the oath of allegiance and sign up to 36 of the 39 articles. So what we have is political freedom, a measure of toleration, and contours of national sovereignty anchored within the nation's Protestantism, the icon of which was, of course, the Bible. This was well drawn in William and Mary's coronation, the service of which was remodelled to highlight the indispensability of their faith. The coronation itself is an immensely ancient service going back in this country to 973, but it had always been changed and tweaked over the centuries, and this is one of those moments when it is changed particularly influentially. This was the first time that a copy of the Bible was carried in procession to Westminster Abbey. The king and the queen had to swear, as none of their predecessors had done, to rule according to the true profession of the gospel and the Protestant reformed religion by law. Once crowned, Bibles were handed to each to put you in mind of this rule that you may follow it. Now, in reality, the new king's personal faith was rather tepid, but his public image was one of Protestant piety. And that Protestantism became even more important as a means of establishing common identity following the Act of Union in 1707, which joined the kingdoms of Scotland and England into Great Britain. In the words of the historian Linda Colley, Protestantism was the foundation that made the invention of Great Britain possible. Now, we may applaud that, but there's one coda to this particular little story, and it's this. It is very important to recognise that grounding national identity in religion is not necessarily healthy. There's a nice illustration of this in a state poem that was published in 1716, which contains the following verse. Under our vines we'll sit and sing, may God be praised, bless George our king, being happy made in everything, both religious and civil. Our fatal discord soon shall cease, composed by George, our Prince of Peace. We shall in plenty live at ease, in spite of Popish envy. Now, it's not the dig at the Catholics that you want to worry about there. They were all doing it at the time. It is the fact that the writer of this particular state poem picks up and draws on two of the most salvific promises of the Old Testament, Micah 4:4 and Isaiah 9:6, under our vines and the Prince of Peace. But he locates that salvation not in King Jesus, but in King George. It's an extraordinarily complacent thing to do, and illustrative of the danger, if only to the church, of anchoring nationhood so firmly within religious identity. Biblical Christianity could and did provide a powerful basis for national identity, but that could come at a cost. So, we have nationhood as one of the ways in which the Bible has influenced our political life. Here's a second example. What is political power for? In other words, what makes a king, or indeed any other political ruler, legitimate? The Bible has, or it can be quoted to justify, a very high view of political power. Old Testament kings were anointed, thereby sanctifying them with the very authority of God. The New Testament is, superficially at least, highly deferential to the powers that be. Romans 13, verses 1 and 2 being the proof texts of choice. Whosoever, therefore, resisteth the power, resisteth the ordinance of God. A hugely influential sentiment, particularly during the Reformation. These views underpinned the view of the emperor that persisted in the Eastern Roman Empire, in which the imperial rank was literally exempted from legislation on the basis that the emperor was himself a living law, and he could not therefore be subject to the law. But the collapse of the Roman Empire in the West took history in a different direction. There, royal power was still validated on biblical grounds, and coronation services were marked with ritual anointing from at least the 8th century onwards. But the closeness, the proximity of the link between the empire and the church was never quite replicated in the West in the way that it was in the East, with churchmen in the West claiming and sometimes even exercising the right to stand apart from and to judge monarchs. This meant that the question of when a king was not a king lay with what the churchmen said and behind them the Bible. And the answer to the question of what made a king legitimate was therefore at root biblical. It was, in effect, when he succeeded or failed to discharge his responsibility to do justice. Kings were not kings by force of arms, or even inheritance. They were, technically, kings by the grace of God. It was not your own merit, but the abundant goodness of God that appointed you king and ruler over many, St. Boniface told King Ethelbert of Mercia. A brave thing to do at the time. Now this, of course, legitimised monarchy, but it also subtly limited it. Because if kings were only kings on account of the goodness of God, it meant that they basically had to pay attention to his terms and conditions, i.e. to do justice. And that placed upon them certain specific duties, such as securing peace, a hugely challenging affair in cultures that were formed effectively by a warrior ethic. Protecting the weak, especially the Old Testament triad of the poor, the widow and the orphan, and defending and advancing the Christian faith. a particular responsibility that would lead both church and monarch down some ethically murky paths over the centuries. Only if the king did this could he rightfully claim the mantle of king. Only then was his power to be considered authority. Now, of course, it took many, many centuries for the implications of this to be worked out in full. But the fact that the seeds were there early on can be seen in a remarkable sermon preached at the end of the 10th century by an Anglo-Saxon monk called Alfric. It's a homily for Palm Sunday, during which he says this: No man can make himself king, but the people has the choice to choose a king whom they please. But after he is consecrated as king, he then has dominion over the people, and they cannot shake his yoke from their necks. No man can make himself king, but the people has a choice to choose a king whom they please. That is an extraordinary sentiment for the 10th century, not so very far away from the ideas of Thomas Hobbes and John Locke 700 years later. There is an irony in this, which is that this strong commitment to justice as the legitimising point of political authority actually impeded our commitment to democracy, which I would take as a third political virtue here. Put simply, if there is a right way to govern and a wrong way to govern, why risk letting people choose the wrong way? There's a beautiful, elegant logic to it. That recognised, and that was undoubtedly the dominant view in this country right the way until at least the 17th century and pretty much into the 19th, the fact is that democracy did, of course, evolve in this country and in advance of virtually every other country. And one of the reasons why it did so is paradoxically down to one of the least democratically minded Christian thinkers in the English tradition, William Tyndale. Now, as I think Lord Bragg mentioned last week, Tyndale is the man in many ways who you have to thank behind the King James Bible. A very large proportion of the New Testament, at least, is derived from his 1526 translation. Tyndale was an extraordinarily brilliant and versatile linguist and one of the supreme wordsmiths of the early Reformation. But he was also about as far from a democrat as it was possible to be. His most substantial work of political theology was called The Obedience of a Christian Man, and it did what it said on the tin. His political theology embraced almost without reservation the extreme political authoritarianism that marked out the early years of the Reformation. We rightly now associate the Reformation and Protestantism with moves forward in political liberty, political freedom, democratic accountability. But it's important to recognise that in the first 30 or 40 years of the Reformation, there was a huge retrograde step in terms of arguments for political resistance, when Luther and Tyndale and others were the leading lights of the early Reformation and by and large supreme political authoritarianisms. Rather embarrassingly for Protestants, particularly English Protestants who took exile in Geneva during Queen Mary's reign in the 1550s, they found themselves having to row back on the political authoritarianism earlier in the century, justify disobedience to the rulers, and then find they had to draw on Catholic theories of political resistance to justify that resistance. So in the long run, the Reformation did have a liberating effect like that, but in the short run, and certainly in the political theory of someone like William Tyndale, it did not. However, there were, in a sense, two William Tyndales. One was the political theorist, and the other was the evangelical, and the evangelical badly undermined the political theorist. Because as an evangelical, Tyndale's overwhelming concern was to make the scriptures accessible to everybody in their own language, no matter how poor or socially browbeaten they were. His famous quote, which there was good evidence that he did say, was to the priest in Gloucestershire, was, if God spare my life, I will make sure that the ploughboy knows as much of Scripture as you do. That possibly wasn't as much a threat as all that, because the evidence we have is that priests in Gloucestershire around the turn of the 16th century didn't know a great deal of Scripture. But the fact it was a ploughboy was deeply subversive. Not only did Tyndale's determination to put the Scriptures, the accessible vernacular Scriptures, in people's hands, but not only was that subversive in itself, but it encouraged people to discuss these documents. It's like putting Magna Carta and Habeas Corpus and the Bill of Rights and the UN Declaration of Human Rights in popularly accessible vernacular, placing them in everybody's hands and saying, there we go, discuss this, think about it for yourselves. It's not an accident that within 2 years of Henry VIII and Thomas Cromwell authorising the Great Bible to be chained to every pulpit in the country so that the people may read and inwardly digest what was written therein, Henry was passing legislation saying, well, when we said everybody, we didn't actually mean everybody. Women shouldn't be allowed to. Labourers shouldn't be allowed to. Craftsmen shouldn't be allowed to. It was simply too subversive. There was a profound spiritual democracy inherent in making the Bible accessible to everybody in their own language. And it was that spiritual democracy that prepared the ground from which ideas of political democracy would subsequently grow. It was only because William Tyndale had done what he had done that Colonel Thomas Rainsborough could remark in the Putney debates in 1647, every man that is to live under a government ought first, by his own consent, to put himself under that government. The Putney debates were comparatively radical at the time, and Rainsborough was comparatively radical within the Putney debaters. Ideas like that were dangerous and were swiftly done away with at the time of the Restoration. It took a long time for them to emerge. But when they emerged again in the maelstrom of the Napoleonic and post-Napoleonic period in the early 19th century in this country, those Christian radicals that were campaigning for the extension of the franchise repeatedly drew on ideas of spiritual democracy to defend the political one. If God considered even the humblest man competent to judge for himself the means of eternal salvation, they contended, and government is simply the means of temporal salvation, it follows that government should involve the people in the formation of its laws. An argument that would have horrified William Tyndale, and yet he was the one who paved the way for it. So we have a commitment to political justice, and to some extent to democracy, that can, without pushing it too far, to be shown to have grown in biblically nourished soil. What about that other, apparently quintessentially modern political virtue, human equality? The ancient world, the ancient Western world, knew of two classes of human, slave and free. And they were so distinct as to be almost different species. Many centuries later, in the immediate post-Darwinian world, Darwin had apparently shown incontrovertibly that, in fact, all human beings are drawn from one stock. We're all means of one family. Therefore, you would have thought that was a basis for equality. And yet, of course, many social Darwinists argued towards the end of the 19th century that, yes, we may have been drawn from the same stock, but our cultural and civilizational courses have taken such profoundly different routes that, in actual fact, we are not equal. Some races are superior to others. We should not underestimate quite how counterintuitive and countercultural, irreducible human equality is. And nor should we underestimate the extent to which our contemporary commitment to that irreducible human equality is drawn from biblical Christianity. More than anywhere else, This commitment is derived from Genesis 1, 26 to 27. And so God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them. Perhaps the single most influential biblical text in British political history. It's not, of course, on the surface of it a political text at all. And yet, the manner in which it has been used has been repeatedly and controversially political. It was here that lay the basis of the priest John Ball's aggressively egalitarian preaching during the Peasants' Revolt of the 14th century, for which he's remembered for a little rhyming ditty. When Adam dug, and Eve span, who was then the gentleman? In other words, where was the inequality in Eden? It was here that laid the basis for John Locke's more sophisticated, and it has to be said more influential, first treatise on government, published in 1689, which methodically demolished Robert Filmer's argument that political inequality was built into creation. Locke's first treatise on government is one of the most important political texts of political philosophy in this country. It's basically an exercise in biblical exegesis, the first treatise is, drawing very heavily on Genesis 1 to counter Robert Filmer's arguments, arguing that human beings are fundamentally equal. That meant that political equality rather than hierarchy is the intended order of things, and that government should be by consent, therefore, rather than natural subservience. It was here that lay the basis for the abolitionist claim that the slave trade was a monstrous abuse of God's own creatures. In actual fact, the image of God was only one of two main pillars for the Christian insistence on equality. The second was its New Testament counterpart. Just as all are made in the image of God, so all are saved, or are at least offered the gift of salvation by the same God. Just as God made all in his image, so Christ offered all his image to replace the broken original. This foundational equality was bolstered from other sources too. The very fact we get so upset about MPs' expenses is, for one of the reasons at least, that we take it for granted that they should be subject to this roughly the same rules as we are. And yet when you think about it in the cold light of day, what earthly reason is there for a political ruler to surrender him or herself to the same rules as his subjects are subject to? It seems self-evidently and obviously right for us, but it hasn't been obvious to a whole host of rulers throughout history, or indeed to a number of North African dictators. One of the reasons, and admittedly it's only one of the reasons, why that view of fundamental rule of law and equality before the law took root in Western Europe was the influence of Deuteronomy 17, 14 to 20. This is a text that explains that when the king of Israel was assuming the throne, he was to write for himself on a scroll a copy of the law. Read it all the days of his life. Follow carefully all the words and not consider himself better than his fellow Israelites. Obviously, a godly people, a Christian people, could be, and we usually were, thoroughly hierarchical. We should not pretend otherwise. But that law limited royal authority and subjected kings to divine judgment just as much as their subjects took root very early in English history. Whether you will or not, King Ethelred was told in the 8th century, you will have him as judge. One final, apparently quintessentially modern political virtue, toleration. Now, to say that Christianity has been intolerant on occasion in its 2,000-year history is to state the obvious. It is also entirely right to say that the Bible has many seeds of intolerance in it. Just put simply, if eternal salvation or damnation is at stake, what does a little temporal coercion matter? Compel them to come in, St. Augustine wrote of the schismatic North African Donatist sect, a hugely important sentiment for the next 1,000 years or more in European history. Yet, if the Bible does contain seeds of intolerance, it also bears seeds of tolerance, or toleration, as it was usually referred to in the 17th century. These came in the concept of adiaphora, the Greek word adiaphora, literally translated things indifferent, and derived primarily from St. Paul's first letter to the Corinthians, and referring to his conviction that some matters, such as eating meat that had been sacrificed to idols, were not essential to faith. The idea bore fruit, albeit painfully slowly and painfully. In the 16th century, when some reformers began to argue that the magistrate's power, which, as I said, they had recently just boosted, needed to be limited. Now, there was, of course, the imperative laid upon the magistrate not to legislate against God's law. Everybody, even Tyndale, even early Luther, recognised that. That was, if you like, universally acknowledged. But some reformers argued there was also an imperative not to command certain indifferent things as if they must be done of necessity. Robert Barnes was another early English reformer, and like Tyndale, a martyr, and he argued that there were a number of activities that God apparently neither prescribed nor proscribed, and that an erroneous situation would be created by enacting them into laws. And it was from this idea that the concept of toleration arose. At first, and not entirely surprisingly, it was advocated most energetically by those who were on the religious periphery, and thus, of course, had most to gain from it, primarily Baptists in the early 17th century. Some, although again not all Baptists, like to quote texts such as Luke 9, when Jesus rebuked those disciples who had wanted to call down fire on a Samaritan village, arguing that Christ had commanded love even for those of a different creed. They cited the parable of the wheat and the tares in Matthew 13, in which Christ explained how the godly and ungodly were to be allowed to grow peacefully alongside one another in the world until God separated them and judged them. In other words, it wasn't the magistrate's job to judge in these matters. Toleration, according to this reasoning, was a Christian duty. It was only the more daring dissenters, as we may anachronistically call them, who argued this in the early 1600s. But by the late 1600s, the idea had gone mainstream, and it had gone particularly mainstream in the work of the rather well-connected, well-respected and learned Anglican philosopher John Locke, whom we have already met once this evening. Locke, in his letter concerning toleration, made the most cogent and, again, thoroughly biblical argument for toleration that had been made up until that point in this country. Locke had initially, interestingly, himself been opposed to religious tolerance. He had grown up during the Civil Wars and the Interregnum, and most people who had grown up during the Civil Wars and the Interregnum were a bit reluctant to admit toleration because they thought it would naturally lead to social anarchy. They had some reasonably good reasons to justify that view. But his experiences abroad and his careful reading of the Gospels persuaded him that, quote, toleration is the chief characteristic mark of the true church. From the admittedly very questionable observation that Scripture speaks very little of politics anywhere, and God doth nowhere by distinct and particular prescriptions set down rules of governments and bound to the magistrate's authority, from that point of view, from that observation, Locke was able to draw a crucial distinction between a sin and a crime, between religious transgressions and political ones. The church had its rightful sphere of spiritual government, and the state had its rightful sphere of temporal government. And short of some gross incursion from one to the other, an incursion that the civilised Locke found hard to imagine, particularly after the Glorious Revolution, those two spheres could happily coexist. Now, many years later, with centuries of hindsight, we can see that Locke's scheme was overly neat and simplistic and came at a cost at the time of effectively enervating the church, because it meant that the church could, by definition, have nothing meaningful to say about political affairs because that wasn't its business. Put that aside. Coming when it did, after 150 years of religious conflict, in which most people were convinced of the idea that the way we address religious conflict is by wiping out people who disagree with us, Locke's was a bold, brilliantly argued, and much-needed justification of toleration. My argument, then, coming to a conclusion, is that just as it is impossible, or at least very difficult, to understand English literary history without recourse to the Bible, so it is very difficult to grasp English or indeed British politics without a similar understanding. To repeat my opening point, that is not to say that the Bible has been the only or a singularly positive influence on British politics. Rather, it's a humbler claim. Whether we admit it or not, and I think we don't often today, many of our deepest political virtues and commitments have been founded on and were shaped by biblical Christianity. This then may strike you as a purely historical claim, but I would contend that there is no such thing as a purely historical claim. It is, of course, true that just because something has been the case, it will not necessarily always be the case, or it should always be the case. A historical claim is not a future prediction, or indeed a normative claim. However, I would suggest our ongoing wrangles over issues of equality and toleration, our rather disappointing lack of faith in politics and public life today, our general confusion over what, if anything, binds us together as a nation, all of these should indicate to us that perhaps we haven't got those questions licked after all. It's one of those ahistorical fallacies to assume that we have moved on from such discussions and that the past has little to teach us because we are so much more liberated and sophisticated than our forebears. Just as we are told we shall always have the poor with us, so we will always have questions of toleration, equality, justice, democracy, and nationhood, questions to which biblical Christianity has much to contribute. I want to leave you with a quotation, one of my favourite quotations. I used it on the epigraph of Freedom and Order, coming from John Locke, as you may have picked up in this lecture. I'm quite a fan of John Locke, influential and in many ways brilliant and inspiring. But this is from a different book, not from his treatise, not from his Letter on Toleration. It's from a book he wrote in 1695 called The Reasonableness of Christianity, which was a defence of Christianity against the deist scare of the time. And at one point in The Reasonableness of Christianity, Locke writes this: "He that travels the roads now applauds his own strength and legs that have carried him so far in such a scantling of time, and ascribes all to his own vigour, little considering how much he owes to their pains, who cleared the woods, drained the bogs, built the bridges, and made the ways possible. In Britain, it has been Christianity that has, albeit slowly and painfully, drained those political bogs, built the bridges and cleared the ways. And I, for one, hope it continues to be involved in our political life in the future." Thank you very much indeed.
Before the Dean expresses appreciation on behalf of us all, we do just have a few minutes in which we can make a comment or ask a question if we wish. The Speaker has kindly said he's very willing to take questions and comments. I think we have a couple of roving mics which are ready and poised to come to you. if you would like to make a comment. If I may just suggest that because of the size of the place and the numbers here, if you could keep your comments or questions be pretty brief and obviously as audible as possible. But if there are any, do just raise your hand pretty firmly. And there's one right over here. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for a fascinating lecture. I've only been to two of these lectures, but I wanted to ask yourself if you believe that we've given the role of the Bible in all these aspects of our history and culture, that our current pupils coming through our schools who perhaps haven't had the education steeped in the King James Bible as perhaps 20, 30 years they might have done, are being done a great disservice, and their future education studying philosophy, history, politics will be far worse for it.
I guess I would say two things to that question. Primarily, I agree with you. I would say two things. Christians have to acknowledge, as I think to be honest with you, most do, that Christianity and Christians themselves and the Bible are one part of a very diverse and very plural public square. We do not have the right of attention that we claimed we did some years ago. If we wish to participate and contribute to public debate, we need to do so in terms and in a tone that is accessible to as many people as possible. So I would say that we can't therefore naturally assume that children must be brought up in the same way as they might have been done 50 or 60 years ago in a slightly more kind of or slightly less kind of culturally and ideologically diverse culture. Having said that, I do believe, and I would apply this more broadly than just to the Bible, just to English history, that it is very difficult to understand who we are and where we are without some idea of where we have been. That isn't to buy into an historical fallacy, which means that the future must always be determined by the past. But I think we do a tremendous disservice to children and indeed to ourselves if we are ignorant of the biblical foundations of our culture, but also the broader historical context in which we are operating.
There's one over here. Thank you.
You've got a microphone coming your way.
I've got two questions. I want a book that will enlighten me more about the Bible as the foundation of the British politics. One, I want a book. Then my second question is, the laws made today, how will we say that the foundation is reflecting on the basic ideas today? That's my second question.
I didn't catch the first question of you, excuse me. I caught the second one. Can you just explain the first one again?
The first one is I would like a book, to read a book more about the foundation.
Well, that's a wonderful question, the first one. And that allows me to give a plug. What a wonderful, thank you so much. Everything I've said tonight is drawn from the book I wrote earlier on this year called Freedom and Order, History, Politics and the English Bible. I would like to say it's available from all good bookstores, but having toured through most good bookstores looking for it, I can safely say that it isn't, but it is at least available on Amazon, Freedom and Order. The second question...
Freedom and Order.
Freedom and Order. The second question about whether the laws we're passing today are Christian or are reflective of our Christian history. Well, Christians themselves will disagree with that. And many will say that is not the case. Some will say at certain years, and I think many others will say it's a very much more complex circumstance. But since I refer you back to my earlier answer, which is, well, I put it another way. I did a debate last week at the Cheltenham Literary Festival on religion and politics, and the chair asked me at one point, quoting something I wrote in Freedom and Order, said, "It seems to me that what you are advocating is a greater Christian presence in political life." And I paused for a second and I said, well, yes, I think I am, really. And there was this intake of breath around the room. I subsequently went on to say, people get involved in political life because they want to influence it. Christians should get involved in public life, and they should do so by joining political parties, by articulating their visions of what is the common good in such a way as hopefully other people will understand them and be attracted by them, and to operate entirely within the political constitutional processes and to accept the results of democratically elected governments. That is what we have to do. If the laws are not to our liking, that is what living in a democracy means. So it may be the case that the laws are un-Christian. I think that's, there's obviously a lot within that statement. But Christians are, comparatively speaking, at least active Christians, a minority, which simply means that the task is to persuade other people who aren't necessarily Christians that the Christian idea of the common good is an appealing one.
Thank you. There was a question here just behind the pulpit. A questioner here.
Thank you for a fascinating talk. I study religion at School of Oriental and African Studies. I just wanted to ask you for your personal opinion on current affairs, actually. At present, we see protesters camping outside, some call it occupying, St. Paul's Cathedral in protest at corporate greed and the system and, you know, all of these big issues. I just wondered what you thought about this and what we can do to help and support if that's the sort of thing we should be doing.
Well, with regard to that specific issue, I think, be wholly supportive. I say that with some reservations because I haven't been following the details of the protest in any great detail. I would be supportive. I think there is, I think we all recognise, there is this residual public anger at the fact that we appear to have returned to a kind of status quo ante following the crash of 2008, and that there are some people who are earning very considerable sums of money whilst there are other people who are suffering quite considerably. I think that this has been exacerbated in the last 3 years, but the fact is that the Gini coefficient, which is the measure of economic inequality in the UK, has been increasing since 1968. We have been becoming a more and more materially unequal country since the late 1960s. So I think as a Christian, I have reservations, severe reservations about that. I'm not necessarily advocating at all sort of equality of outcome, but the way that some activities seem to be valued so very much more highly than other activities, when those other activities appear to be contributing more to the common good and social cohesion, does give me cause for concern.
Thank you. It's just the last one, I think, and time for that, right there.
Thank you very much for your talk. I'm interested in the question of looking to the future with the Bible. I have relatively recently become Muslim and read the Quran through twice now. And there is so much reference backwards from the Quran to the Bible. And I wondered if any of your work you've looked at the extent to which your analysis of the Bible in law can be made relevant to other sectors of the population other than Christians, because there is a huge bridge between the two scripts. And I think if that was made more explicit, there would be more understanding of how both scripts relate to the law in Britain. And I wondered if you'd done work in this area.
A very good question. The short answer is we haven't done work in this area. I'm presumably be aware of the enterprise called Scriptural Reasoning, in which particularly members of the three major monotheistic faiths come together and reason together explicitly from the basis of their holy texts in such a way as to introduce and engage other people with the way that they think. To me, that is the most positive positive move in this area. I think that there is, with regard to Islam, certainly with regard to Christianity, and I guess also with regard to Judaism, although less so, a certain degree of public ignorance which breeds a certain degree of public fear, which means that if you hold a sacred text as authoritative, you therefore, at best, throw your brain away, and at worst, allow yourself to be brainwashed. And the idea that you can reason with and from an authoritative set of scriptures is anathema, very unfamiliar to many people. To my mind, that is a very productive enterprise, and I guess that would be my answer in terms of, you know, bridging gaps and improving dialogue in the future. That would be the most profitable way of proceeding.
I'm very grateful for the questions, and of course to the speaker, but I'm now going to ask the Dean if he would thank him on our behalf.
Nick, you've once more attracted, for the third of our lectures here, a large crowd and immensely appreciative. I want to express on everyone's behalf our thanks to you for what you've given us this evening, the very wide range of your learning, and as in previous lectures, your humour applied to it has been immensely attractive. What you've not, of course, said is that there is any particular unique set of political conclusions out of the Bible. And I was led to reflect during the time that you were speaking and indeed answering those fascinating and really important questions on the link between John Locke and Westminster Abbey. John Locke having been a pupil of Westminster School, as, of course, Nick Clegg was, as Chris Hume was, as Dominic Grieve was, as Tony Benn was. And I had the extraordinary experience of attending a lunchtime session of the John Locke Society in Westminster School, where Tony Benn made his first return visit to the school since having himself been a schoolboy there, and entertained and in many ways captivated the audience with his political views. But that range of people nurtured to some degree within this place just remind us of the breadth of possible response, which is still inspired by Christian faith, by the Bible. I want to take this opportunity of paying public tribute to the work of Theos and to your work as part of Theos. It seems to me that the Bible Society's initiative in establishing Theos and the contribution that Theos makes to our public discourse and to serious engagement with the issue of faith in the public square, as you say, language which we're all beginning to adopt, that initiative has been immensely significant, and the work that you do and your colleagues do is of very great importance, and it's a real delight to me that we're associated in a number of different ways with the Theos project. Thank you so much for your lecture tonight. I'm sure that many other people will also want to at least look on Amazon and find Freedom and Order, but I shouldn't be plugging Amazon myself. There are good bookshops, and many of them have it. And if not, they'll order it. It's there. And thank you. And that brings us to the end of this series of lectures. I think it's been very good. I've been absolutely thrilled as a trustee of the King James Bible Trust. There are a few more events related to the Quater Centenary in the rest of this year. Later this month, we have some of the 66 plays that Bush have been producing being enacted here overnight. We have the great service on the 16th of November. I hope you will be amused by the choice of date, the 16th of November 2011, at which the Archbishop of Canterbury will preach, and the Abbey will be full in celebration of the Quater Centenary on that occasion. Then there's a performance of The Messiah, but I gather that may already have been sold out later in November here. So we shall be continuing to celebrate the 400th anniversary of the King James Bible. And what I hope above all and pray above all is that through this anniversary, many people will have come back, not just to thinking about the language of the King James Bible, but just to be reminded of the extraordinary impact that the Bible has had on our society in so many ways and can have and I pray will have, especially as young people are better educated and nurtured. And I hope there are many school teachers who've been inspired by this Quater Centenary just to say, what part should my teaching play in bringing people back to these sacred texts and vital texts for our life together? Thank you very much indeed.